Welcome to the University of Michigan Press podcast, featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors.
The 1950s marked a radical transformation in American popular music, as the nation drifted away from its love affair with big band swing to embrace the unschooled and unruly new sounds of rock and roll. The sudden flood of records from the margins of the music industry left impressions on the pop soundscape that would eventually reshape long-established listening habits and expectations, as well as conventions of songwriting, performance, and recording. When Elvis Presley claimed, "I don't sound like nobody," a year before he made his first commercial record, he unwittingly articulated the era's musical zeitgeist. The central storyline of "I don't sound like nobody" is change itself. The book's characters include not just performers, but engineers, producers, songwriters, label owners, radio personalities, and fans, all of them key players in the decade's musical transformation. Written in engaging, accessible prose, Alban Zak's I Don't Sound Like Nobody approaches musical and historical issues of the 1950s through the lens of recordings, and fashions a compelling story of the birth of a new musical language. The book belongs on the shelf of every modern music aficionado and every scholar of rock and roll. Alban J. Zak III is professor of music at the University at Albany, State University of New York. He is the editor of The Velvet Underground Companion and the author of The Poetics of Rock, Cutting Tracks, Making Records, a groundbreaking study of rock music production. Zak is also a record producer, songwriter, singer, and guitarist. Hi, Professor Zak.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. So what makes the 1950s such an important period in the history of popular music?
Well, it's the time when so much that was understood to be popular music through the 1930s and 1940s changed dramatically. If you think of the most popular, well, among the most popular groups of the 1940s was Glenn Miller, the Glenn Miller Orchestra. And, of course, among the most popular groups of the 60s was the Beatles. And, I mean, those are just two really different kinds of music making on all levels. And what comes in between there is the 1950s. So the question is, what happened and how did so much happen so quickly? So in order to figure that out, you have to dig down into the weeds of the 1950s.
Okay, so how is rock and roll different from what came before it?
Well, there were so many things that sort of became acceptable as musical sound through rock and roll that just were not before that, whether it was the fact that you had amateur musicians, amateur songwriters, amateur arrangers doing things that the old pros thought were just kind of ridiculous and silly. That's why there was such a critical backlash against rock and roll by, you know, anybody who had been around the music business for a while. It didn't seem like it was ready for prime time, and yet it was so popular. So one thing is that just all of these new kinds of sounds that would have previously been unacceptable, and all of these new characters who seem to come out of nowhere. I mean, they make one record, and all of a sudden they were famous, having had no apprenticeship or put in no time in the music business before that. The whole spectrum of what pop music was just became broader and broader and broader, because at the same time, what had been popular before rock and roll came along, that did not go away. That was still all through the 50s. That was still on the charts and in people's hearts. And so when you added rock and roll, it wasn't like one thing replaced another thing. It's just that the whole spectrum of what counted as pop music got broader and broader throughout the decade and more complex. You know, rock and roll completely overturned ideas of stylistic integrity and authenticity. You know, there were just certain ways that a person would sound and certain kinds of musical style things that a piece of music would do if it was going to call itself a country song or rhythm and blues song or whatever. Now, there was a lot of mixing and matching stylistically that was starting to go on in these other idioms as well, like rhythm and blues records with string sections or country records with bass clarinet on, you know. But rock and roll took that idea to a new height because it wasn't a music of its own. It was just some kids putting out whatever kinds of scraps of music were in their memories and imaginations. They sort of strung them together. So they had no compunction about borrowing, stealing, whatever, from all these different idioms, and mixing them all up together in the same, on the same record, you know, in the same song. So it's kind of a paradox of rock and roll, that the more it borrows from other idioms, the more it becomes itself, because what finally turned it into an idiom, let me put it another way. Once it finally becomes an established idiom of its own, what it asserts is that stylistic inclusion is part of what defines it as a distinctive idiom. It's more inclusive of all kinds of style, whether it's gospel, jazz, country, R&B, classical, any place it can just borrow scraps and bits of music, it will do so. And in doing that, it defines itself as a distinct musical idiom. It's kind of an odd, sounds contradictory, but it's very interesting. And again, that's something which remains with us to this day. And again, it's something you hear a lot in hip-hop.
And how did it change the, you know, the conventions of music creation and distribution and all that?
Well, I guess it changed many, many things. But if you had to come down to one basic thing, it had to do with the fact that records were the primary sort of currency for rock and roll. Records had been increasing in importance since the war. Record sales had skyrocketed after the war. So even for the pre-rock and roll pop music, records were more important than ever. But by the time you got these rock and roll records starting to cross over into the mainstream, you began to see a phenomenon where records were more important than anything else as far as breaking new acts and putting them into the mainstream of the public musical consciousness. And so then, therefore, the rock and roll musicians and the rock and roll producers and the songwriters and everybody, they focused more and more and more on records. Whereas before, you know, this focus had always been on songs and therefore the song sheets, the sheet music that was the backbone of the business. That wasn't the case anymore. Of course, you still had songs, but now the songs could be just very sketchy, minimalist things that if you wrote them down on paper didn't amount to very much because they were only like the screenplay for the movie. You know, they weren't the movie, they were just the beginning. And from the song would flow the overall production, and then you would get, you know, the finished work, which was the record. So rock and roll sort of just made this what had been growing in importance, which was the recording. It made it into the prime currency in the pop marketplace. And once you do that, then all of the things that go into making a record, the performances and the sounds and the arrangements, that all becomes part of the creative process in a way that it had never been before. Because before you would try to do those creative things, the songwriting, the arranging, before you went to the studio. And you went to the studio just to make a good performance, don't make any mistakes, make it sound good, and out it goes. With the rock and roll, you go into the studio, maybe you hardly have anything. And you just go in and you see what happens. And so the whole experimental, you know, creative vibe extended into the recording studio. And well, the distribution kind of goes along with that in the sense that when records became the prime currency, now you've got completely formed musical, you know, experiences. The people don't have to take them home and play them on their ukulele or their piano, which you would have to do with sheet music. They just put it on their record player and listen to it, and they get the whole thing. So now you get these things, these records, they're sort of filtering out everywhere. Of course, they're on the radio all the time, and they're in jukeboxes everywhere you go, but they're also, you know, in the retail stores, and so they're in people's houses, and they turn up in all kinds of unexpected places. So before this, you know, the markets were pretty well defined for the record people. They thought they knew who liked what and what kind of music they would mark to that particular demographic. But records were so kind of slippery, you know, and they would start crossing over, you know, social boundaries, and you had people listening to music that record men had not expected them to be going for. And it sort of started to create a grassroots churning that went sort of throughout the whole musical economy and the whole musical culture. So the distribution became very confused and chaotic for the record men. They didn't, you know, all you want to know if you have a bunch of jukeboxes in some taverns is what kind of records to put in there, because you want people to put their nickels in. And so as long as that was well understood, you could put your country music records in for this clientele, your rhythm and blues records for that kind of clientele, it was all good. But when people started to demand records that they hadn't, that the jukebox operators had never before put into their venues, they started to get confused and go back to the industry and say, hey, what's going on? What's going on? And the industry said, we don't know what's going on. So what it does is then, you know, when the record becomes so ubiquitous out there, it had a real democratizing sort of role. It gave people sort of at the grassroots a sort of a power to say what they liked and what they didn't like. And everybody was listening, whether it was the DJs, the record men, the jukebox operators, you know, they just wanted to give the public what they wanted because they wanted to make money. And so as long as you had a way for the public to give the sort of instant feedback, it you know, started to challenge all kinds of established, you know, conventional wisdom that had worked for the industry for a long time, and suddenly it didn't work anymore. And it kept not working. Through the 50s, it got more and more confusing. I mean, by the time Elvis came in, really came on the scene in 1956, you know, it blew people's minds, but they had their minds blown quite a bit for the first half of the 50s anyway, through all kinds of what they consider to be strange occurrences.
So was there a person in that decade with, you know, that influenced this whole pop transformation?
I don't think you can put it down to a person, you know, because, because the public had such a say in it, it was kind of just really, really widespread. But it is interesting to look at the two most important figures in terms of sales numbers and how different they are. And that then gives you sort of a sense of the spectrum of what was going on. So that would be one person, of course, would be Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll. And the reason he was the king of rock and roll is he just sold more records than anybody. And he sold them to every audience, because his records would be number one on the pop charts and the country charts and the rhythm and blues charts at the same time. That was incredibly unusual, and he did it over and over and over. The other figure would be Mitch Miller, who hated rock and roll, who was not a performer. He was a record producer, but he was the producer for so many of the top acts, you know, Johnny Ray, Rosemary Clooney, Tony Bennett, on and on. So many of the top pop record sellers and hit makers of the day. So you have these two figures who, throughout the 50s, are key players. One represents, you know, the performing side of things. One represents the in the studio side of things. One represents rock and roll. One represents mainstream pop. Though again, the pop was very different from what Glenn Miller had put out there. And so somehow between the range of musics that you get represented by those two figures, you get a sense for the complexity, the tensions, that sort of inhabited and kind of roiled the musical culture through the 1950s. Because the thing to remember, that what would make such a tumultuous revolutionary period happen had to involve a lot of tension, you know, a lot of just creative destruction and people not knowing what to do next. So they really had to always be on their toes and thinking creatively and doing just, you know, over-the-top and unprecedented things just for the sake of surviving in the marketplace, trying to sell records and stay, especially with the small record companies, to stay open one more week, one more month. And all of that sort of fuels such a dynamism that's why you can't really put it down to one particular figure. It was this entire dynamic culture that fueled the whole process of change.
But, you know, going back to Elvis Presley really quickly, that's actually where your title comes from for the book, correct? That's a quote from him? I Don't Sound Like Nobody?
Right. That's a quote from him. And the reason I chose it is that, on the one hand, he was talking about himself when he was asked by Marion Kiesker, who worked at Sun Records, well, who do you sound like, you know, before he had made any recordings. And he sort of, I think, you know, it sounds a little bit like a boast, but I think partly he just really didn't know how to describe himself, because he did sort of, you know, include all of these different stylistic elements in what he did. But at the same time, he was also describing, probably unwittingly, but he was describing a state of affairs, you know. There was so much about the pop world in the years before he even came along that didn't sound like anybody or anything as far as the way pop had been in earlier years. So it was kind of a neat little encapsulation of what was going on in the pop universe that you know, nobody sounded like nobody. You know, if you took what had been pretty stable conventions of the swing era of what pop music sounded like, well, you know, Mitch Miller's stuff didn't sound like any of that either, even though that was, you know, the so-called mainstream pop of the early 50s. As far as if you think of rock and roll as a revolutionary music, well, it was kind of the second in line. And I mean, it was the second in the sequence, because the mainstream pop, starting in, you know, I don't know, 48, 49, 50, it was already getting really pretty weird and pretty radical and very unlike the swing music that had preceded it.
So what is the impact of those changes on today's music?
Well, the thing about today's music, we take so much of this for granted now, but we're really doing the same thing they did in the 50s, conceptually. You know, the artists change and the styles change, but we're still making records of songs. You know, we still have, you know, rock bands, pretty much, you know, like rock bands were. I mean, guitar, bass, and drums. But the main thing is this focus on record making, on going into the studio and concocting something, you know, just going in and using your imagination to take advantage of all the artifice that the studio offers you. I mean, if you think about, there's so much, you know, so many kinds of rock today that are kind of just continuations of what we had in the 60s. But I guess the most really different sounding idiom to come along in the last 30 years would have to be, you know, hip-hop and rap. It's something that's just really quite a different approach to music in many ways from any of the other pop musics that preceded it. And yet, if you look at it, I mean, what the center of hip-hop is record making, you know, making beats, working in studios, making these really creative and often very over-the-top sorts of records, like the Kanye West album from last year, where he used the auto-tune on every single song on his voice. I mean, things are clearly not meant to sound like natural reproductions of the acoustic, the natural acoustic world, which is how records used to be made, you know, before the 50s. So this idea that the studio is a place where you go and you treat it like you're going to be making a movie rather than just capturing a performance. It's like when Hendrix made Electric Ladyland, he wrote on it, on the album, you know, produced and directed by Jimi Hendrix, you know, really giving it a sense that his conception of the thing was like he was making a movie. He wasn't just capturing performances. So that attitude of going into the studio and treating it as a place to make independent artworks, not just, you know, sing a song and put up a microphone, that's still with us. And whatever new genres have come along, in the meantime, they all still have that attitude as sort of a fundamental belief.
Well, very interesting stuff. Thanks so much, Professor Zach, for taking the time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Alvin Zach, author of I Don't Sound Like Nobody, Remaking Music in 1950s America. To learn more about our books, visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, all rights reserved.